Thank you very much, Latham, for the invitation. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'll admit, I've been doing a lot of speaking of public and conferences on this material, but I'm pretty nervous. Our perimeter home court, so to speak, for me is tough. You guys are so smart, so diverse. I'm sure there are friends and colleagues going to say, what the hell is he doing? Why is he doing that? And one of the reasons I'm giving this talk is to give some sense and some logic to what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and what we are achieving, which I hope will be worth your time to listen to. Now, different people, let's see. Oh, that's right. There we are. Different people organize their research differently and strategize in different ways, with some with a lot of foresight, some just spontaneously. I tend to try to think about where we're going. And since where we're going, for me, is a new theory, a radically new theory, I think in terms of principles. And in this talk, I'm going to talk about four principles which have underlined my own research for really most of the time I've been doing research. Let me just enumerate them here. And then we're going to discuss one by one the different principles and how they, to me, motivate me for different research directions in different fields. I work in quantum gravity. I work in quantum foundations. I sometimes have done work which is relevant for cosmology, for particle physics. And I want to make a picture of how these different things fit together and give you a sense of where it's all going. So the first principle for me is always relationalism. The idea that every question about the universe, why is it this way and not that way? Why is it not 10 feet to the left, or why didn't start an hour later, has to have a rational or a sufficient answer. And that's called the principle of sufficient reason. And these two principles, which we build the idea of relationalism on, go back to Leibniz, of course. The other principle is the principle of the identity of the indiscernible. And this we'll see has a lot to say to physicists trying to make fundamental physics. It says if there are two events or two objects which have the same properties, then we identify them. So this, for example, doesn't allow us to think about space-times that have symmetries. So there are points that are identical in the properties just related by symmetry. The second principle is realism. That is, I'm not interested in a good enough operational. I have very good friends who try to construct operational versions of quantum physics particularly. I'm interested in knowing, and I believe we can know, everything that's going on in every interaction. We may not be able to predict it, but we should be able to describe it. And that makes me a realist. And one of the questions a realist has to answer is, what do you think is real? And what do you think is not real? Emergent comes along later in the story. And that we'll spend some time on that. And then the fourth one is the principle of dualities. And there are many interesting ways in which turning physics on its head by a duality plays a role. And we'll come to that. And the third one I'll let go to when we get to it, because it will be less familiar to people. Now, these different principles have in different ways motivated the work that I've been interested in the different fields I work in. if you think about the first two and then the fourth, they are, and you think about quantum gravity, as in some sense Leibniz was, because Leibniz was trying to invent a world very much like the world we are trying to invent when we make fundamental theories of quantum gravity and the other interactions. To me, we already get a story that our world has to be made out of relational properties. That is, a relational property is a property of something, say, that's moving, where its motion is defined with respect to other things that are moving and not with respect to some absolute structure. And the idea that there's no fixed background, what we call background independence, which some people argue about, comes from this. In quantum foundations, these principles tell me that we should look for a realistic completion of quantum mechanics, defined again in terms of the same kind of relational properties and structures as in quantum gravity. And indeed, for me, quantum gravity and quantum foundations are the same problem. One is never far from thinking about the other. If we are trying to invent a new theory of quantum mechanics, which we know has to be non-local radically, as far as space is concerned, we're really trying to invent a new theory of space, which really means we're thinking about quantum gravity and so forth. Now, particle physics is often pursued apart from these theories. Many people in particle physics think of what we do as effective field theory as divorced from quantum gravity, because I think they mistakenly think that quantum gravity is restricted to the Planck scale. But to me, if we're thinking about particle physics, we're thinking, to me, the most important problem in particle physics is the one that we failed to solve year after year after year, which is to explain the structure of the standard model. Where does it come from? And where do the values of the parameters come from? In other words, why do we have these laws and not these other laws? Because mathematically, the language, whether we use effective field theory or some string-related language or loop quantum gravity-related language, we are very uncomfortably aware that we could change the values of the parameters, change the gauge groups, change the assignments of representations of the fermions, keeping only anomaly-free representations, and we'd get an equally consistent theory as a standard model. And this bothers me. And the only kind of answer I can think of, which again is motivated by these kinds of thinking about being a realist and being a relationalist, is that there's some dynamics. That is, the universe we confront is not the result of mathematical symmetries or eternal mathematical constructions. It's the result of some dynamics. And we should find out what that dynamics is. And I'm going to have, towards the end of this talk, a proposal for that. And then I think unusually amongst my colleagues who think about these things, am convinced that time is fundamental. In fact, that space is emergent and comes later in the story. And this really comes also from thinking about these things. So that's where we're going. Let me just go back and go through the first two principles and tie down what to me they imply. So relationalism is almost the same thing as saying what we mean, if we mean it. When we say background independence, we mean there's no fixed structures that are not degrees of freedom. There's no fixed metric, either on space-time or on Hilbert space. There's no fixed asymptotic conditions. The universe we want to be causally closed. That is, there are no causes of anything which are outside the dynamical system, which is all the interacting degrees of freedom in the universe. So, for example, I don't think that there are laws which don't evolve in some sense, because that would be something outside the system of the universe. There's no symmetries that Roger Penrose, among other people, told me that when I was a graduate student. There are no symmetries. And indeed, there are no symmetries in classical general relativity when you have closed boundary conditions. And I'll argue a little later about dualities are wonderful, but dualities all want to become trialities. And I'll explain what that means. I'm a realist, and as a realist, I hope for a complete explanation of every individual event. Quantum mechanics is really cool. I love using quantum mechanics, but it needs a completion. It's an incomplete description. So let's find it. That's our job, in my opinion. So, as I said, if I'm going to be a realist, it's not just philosophical blah, blah, blah about different criteria. I should tell you what I think is real. And as a theoretical physicist, different of us make different bets, different guesses as to what's real. And that is where you put down the architecture of your theory and you begin to build on it. So I like to think about events as real and fundamental. And events have causal relations, that is, an event happens and it happens for a reason because some previous events happened, each of them happened for a reason, and so forth. And that event I started with will be a progenitor, part of the reason for a later event. And those are causal relations. And Raphael and Fay and Sumadhi and others' friends like to say that the world is nothing but events in those causal relations. That's called pure causal set theory. And I believe in events and causal relations, but I don't believe that's all in the world. And this is a very important place where my work and the work of people I've been working with takes direction. I believe that energy and momentum are fundamental. They're before space. We'll get to space, but at the moment, we have no space in the description of any kind, but we do have momentum and energy. And momentum and energy are propagated from event to event along the causal relations. Now, these all can be mixed up and presented in different ways. And the way I think it's useful to present them is to think about a given event and the news about its past that comes to it from the quanta, from the causal relations that cause it. Every event has a, if it were a smooth classical description, in general relativity, we would say every event has a back, has a causal past whose boundary is the backward light cone. And this is what I mean when I talk of the view of events. The view of events is the news about how that event relates to the universe, that how, what it knows, if you like, when it looks around, if you want to anthropomorphize it. I sit here, I look up at the sky, and that's my view. Okay, that's going to be the most important new concept in this talk. And we'll come to the last one in a little bit. So if you are interested in the idea that they're just events and causal relations, you study a very simple dynamical system. You have to somehow give an action principle for just that raw data. And some very interesting work comes out of that, but that's not the direction we're going today. The direction we're going is to have energy and momentum propagating up those causal relations. And we put on the constraint that it's conserved at every event. So at, say, the event I, it receives energy and momentum from event K and event J, and it distributes them out to event M and event L, and there is a constraint at for every event that governs the conservation of energy and momentum of that event. Now, I'm sure that somebody's going to raise their hands and say, wait a minute, energy and momentum are conserved because of the symmetries of space and time. That's Noether's theorem, because of the translation symmetry in space and time. So you can't have energy and momentum conserved before you have space and time and they have symmetries. But that's exactly what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there's something like an inverse Noether's theorem. And we have examples of it with Marina Cortez, who, by the way, is we developed this whole framework with, in which later you can show that space emerges as a consequence of the relations for momentum conservation being consistent in the solution of the theory. But that, and I'll come to that more specifically, but please don't complain that we have energy and momentum before space. It's logically possible, and there it is. So I told you before about the view of an event, the news that's incoming to that event, and I just give you a picture of the view. The view for every event can be thought of as a two-sphere into which, or just into which, are all the momentum energy vectors coming into the event, and each one comes in with a direction which gives a point on the two-sphere and a magnitude, say if these are massless particles, which is the total energy in the frame of reference in which the event is stationary. And so we've been hearing a lot recently about the celestial sky and formulating physics, the celestial sphere and formulating physics in terms of conformal field theory on the celestial sphere. And this connects up to that whole program right there. So that's what the view of an event is. And I said we'll talk a lot about them. That's just another picture of what I said. And now I want to use an idea and a result which seems to me very crucial for one of the main problems that we argue about in quantum gravity, which is what are the observables? What are good observables? If you think, as I often do and have, that we're quantizing general relativity or some other theory, then an event starts out as an event in classical general relativity. And we know that has to be diffeomorphism invariant, independent of both the spatial and the space-time reparameterizations, the diffeomorphisms. And we know those are rare. They're hard to construct, especially to make them have local information. But I'm using here a strategy which goes back to Peter Bergman and people in the 1950s, where they said, let's turn it around and let's think of an event in space-time and let's think that we're going to define that event by what it sees when it looks around. In other words, what its sky is or what its view is. And we're going to take four bits of that information to define its space-time location in an invariant way. And we're going to talk about observers like, I wonder if there is an event in space-time that sees this in the electromagnetic fields when it looks around. And then I'm going to want to observe the neutrinos and see what neutrino radiation it sees, or the gravitational radiation. And these kinds of observables are diffeomorphism invariant, and they give us local information about events under the circumstance, which I want to emphasize right now, that the view of every event in the universe is unique, so the events can be labeled by their views. Now, there doesn't have to be an event for every possible view. Indeed, I can argue that perhaps the universe is very sparse in how it calculates the states of possible views. But there has to be no more than one event per view. That is, each view has to be unique. And this is a definition of generic space-times, and I'm going to impose it. Indeed, I'm going to only be interested in space-times that are possibly real, and I think this is a property that our universe has, that as big as it is, every event has its slightly unique own view of the universe. And as I say, under those conditions, those are invariant under space-time diffeomorphisms. They are real physical observables, and those are the observables under which I build my physics. Okay. So we're taking a very different strategy right here to the question of what are the observables? And it's crucial for what follows. Now, there's no space. We still haven't talked about space, just views. And the views are built from incoming energy momentum vectors to events. So I don't have to talk about space. So how am I going to do physics? How am I going to write down dynamics? How am I going to talk about an action principle? There's no distances. I can't do Newtonian mechanics. I can't talk about 1/r forces or something like that. There's no fields because there's no x to have phi of x. There's no derivatives. So I can't talk about usual Lagrangian principles for particles as we usually describe them. What do I got to build physics out of? And what I have is the views and the differences between the views. So I'm going to have a metric, and this is, I will admit, prior structure. I'm going to put a metric on the space of views. Huh? Hello, somebody? I'm going to put a metric on the space of views, hij. Oh, wow. And relate that to the distance.
That team is a talk.
Hey, who's there? Okay, somebody seems to be talking, but I'll go out.
I think I muted them.
Okay. And so between every two views, there's how different they are. And then I also want to have a measure. If I have a whole causal history of events and their views, I want to talk about how varied is the set of all those views. That is, I'm going to take every pair of views, measure their difference, and add that up over all the pairs. And that's called the variety of the universe, or the variety of the system of causal relations. And roughly speaking, I'll be a little bit more precise in a few minutes, that's going to give us the potential energy, and changes in that as we go through the causal relations are going to give us the kinetic energy of the universe. So I'm making a dynamics for a system which, when we get down to the level of general relativity, several emergent layers later, the was already made out of things that are diffeomorphisms, that are well-defined. Okay, and that's my third principle. My third principle is essentially that the dynamics in the universe is trying to maximize the diversity of the views. And that explains my slightly comic title. So, since I'm also thinking about quantum foundations, and I'm a realist, I'm thinking about what John Bell called a beable. what is not just something which is observable, but in the quantum world, going to be something that we assert exists, a beable. And these views are the beables. And you can check that they indeed are made out of information whose representatives commute as canonical objects or as operators. But that's, we can talk about that. That's a technical remark. But the fact that that is true means that I can go to a representation which diagonalizes all the information coming into these views. Now, this is just a kind of recap slide. We're not gonna dwell much on it. But the important thing is understand what I'm doing. I'm trading the basic structure of physics, which is space, distances, fields, derivatives, etc. I'm trading that for one thing, which is the views and the differences between the views of the different events in the universe. And everything that follows, follows from that trade. Now there's a loose relationship between them. If we're both standing in the field looking at the sky, we have similar views because we're close to each other. So in a coarse-grained sense, we can train closeness to each other for having similarity of views. And of course, I use that in the derivations, but only in a coarse-grained way. There are lots of cases where we may be close to each other, say on one side or another of that door, and have very different views. And there are also, we also think of events of microscopic things that have very few degrees of freedom that define their views. Say an electron in a hydrogen or a water molecule, and they can have similar views accidentally because they just don't have that many degrees of freedom, and there are vast numbers of them in the universe. And that's the beginning of my story for what quantum physics is about. Quantum physics is a description of the ensembles that come to exist because systems with very few degrees of freedom for their views are going to interact with each other if systems that are large systems that are near to each other in what we used to call space are going to interact with each other. And I'll come to as much of that as I can get to. Another way of saying that is because similarity of views tracks nearness only approximately, locality is disordered. By the time we get space to emerge, there are most of the time similarity has tracked nearness in the metric of space-time, but there's lots of disordering, and that will give rise to quantum non-locality, entanglement, and so forth. So I talked before about what is fundamental as a realist, and it's those time, events, energy, momentum, etc. What is emergent in this physics? And of course, it's everything else. So space is emergent. And it's emergent from, as I tried to indicate, similarity of views. Particles are emergent. And I can show in models exactly how the idea of localized particles traveling is emergent. Those particles have some interactions, and that's emergent. Locality is emergent, therefore so is non-locality, and so is the distinction between them, and that's why there's quantum mechanics. And these are, I should mention, these are, what's here in this red box is been published for 3 or 4 years, so this is not, I've said this before in talks. There's a number of papers which go into details about it. If I had lots and lots of time in this talk, I would show all those derivations, and I'm happy to in the discussion. But we're going to, I want to talk about some new stuff. So I'm not going to go into as much detail defending those claims as I would otherwise. Okay, this is a MAPA review slide. Well, this is a review slide. Let me just point out the bottom. Kinetic energy is the sum over all events of the sum over those events that immediately precede them of the differences between the views. So that's basically related to taking the time derivative. It's asking how does the backward pass, the causal pass, change as you go up in elementary causal relations. And that's related to the kinetic energy of my system. Just a little sideshow, and I only have time for a few sideshows. But let me bring in the fourth principle, which is duality. And I have several dualities in mind. One of them is the one which has had the most influence on quantum field theory, particle physics, and quantum gravity. There's a duality that Particoff and Wilson and others discovered between the quantization of a gauge field and an extended object like a flux line of quantized magnetic flux or quantized electric flux. And I'm going to assume this duality, that is, we're going to treat gauge fields by quantizing them in the dual representations, of which there is a lot to say, where the configuration spaces of the degrees of freedom are lines of quantized electric flux. Of course, the study of this came out of QCD. And I'm just going to note something that Abba Ashtekar taught us, that the fundamental configuration space of general relativity is a space of gauge fields. It's not a space of metrics. And therefore, if quantized gauge theories are quantized in a dual representation where the electric field flux is quantized, hence the same is true for general relativity, and hence we have quantum geometry. That is, we have a distinct structure of quantized area and volume, et cetera. And the dynamics of quantum general relativity are about the dynamics of those networks. And that's, of course, loop quantum gravity in a sense. And that fits right in with the rest of the picture. And there's a lot to say about this. There isn't time to say about particularly that holography is already represented in the relationship, which is already built in between the area of surfaces, which is discrete, and the channel capacity for information to pass through those surfaces. It's built in, and therefore when people come to me and say, we should make a principle of the holographic principle, I say maybe, but it's already there as a consequence of the other principles. So now I want to turn to my colleagues and friends in quantum foundations, because what I've just said, it may seem that I've been talking about quantum gravity and quantum geometry, but I also believe I've been talking about quantum foundation. That is, I've been discussing the consequences of principles that govern fundamental quantum theories. And already we have the idea built into everything I've said so far that space is emergent, so locality is emergent, so non-locality is emergent. We have the idea that the dynamics of these networks is governed by this quantity of variety to make the networks as diverse as possible by making their views as large as possible. And this, I claim, is all part of how we make a completion of quantum mechanics. And that's worth a talk all by itself. But that has to be emphasized. Okay, so the idea, so thinking about what I've just been saying, back in the 80s, when I was a postdoc at Princeton, I started to think about how to complete quantum mechanics, given all of this background, which was running around looking for a place to go, so to speak. And I began to think that the hidden variables that Einstein and others talked about, that they were mistaken as to the nature of the hidden variables. They'd always seemed like they thought that if you're talking about an electron, the hidden variable is a more detailed description of the state of that electron. And that's supposed to help you understand the quantum mechanics of that electron. The view that I began to think about is that the hidden variables are more information about how that electron is related to and connected to the rest of the universe. Thinking again that space emerges out of these network of causal relations, and that there's a lot of disordering. There's a lot of accidentally non-local connections as the network emerges. I started to think about, can you make a hidden variable theory for quantum mechanics? And it usually ends up with a many-body quantum mechanics, in which the degrees of freedom of that more fundamental theory are relational, are networks or graphs or matrices, which can often be used to code the information in a network or a graph, like the adjacency matrix. And I began to play with the dynamics of matrices and graphs and networks and see if it were possible to derive quantum mechanics directly from them. And what I was thinking of is that there would be some n, which was something like the number of particles in the system, and an order zero in 1/n, space would emerge. And as I indicated, that's what happens in the energetic causal sets when we get the a solution that has the right conservation laws. And to 1/n or 1/√n, the disordered part of the locality, that is non-locality, would raise its head in exactly the right way and give us quantum dynamics. And that the Schrodinger equation basically can be seen as a noise term that satisfies certain very strict constraints. And that noise term, the noise would come from all these non-local couplings in the universe. And I wrote papers about that, in not a lot of them, but over the years, eventually 385, 86. And I also collaborated with Julian Barber, with Fortuna Markopoulou on this. So this was a sort of attempt to construct a relational hidden variable theory. And there were some successes, but we're not going to talk about them now. I'm going to say a little bit more about variety, but I'm really just going to show you some pictures. Look in the red circle. And the red circle, there are two red circles there, and each of them encircles an event, and we see relations to other events coming out represented by the lines of the graph. And we want to ask, for every pair of events or nodes in the graph, how different are those neighborhoods? And we sum them up. And for different reasons at different times, I've been played that game, or I've been working with people who played that game. And that's a picture of a set with, those are other sets. These pictures come from theoretical biology, but they have, interestingly enough, high values of variety. I'm gonna be talking at the end of work that is going on right now, which I hope I can excite you with, by Stefan Sinovich, Michael Toomey, Will Cunningham here, David Wacker at Microsoft Research, Stefan Alexander, who I saw very recently on the screen, so I know Steph is here, and Jaron Lanier. And we have been motivated to make very high variety sets and see what their properties are. For example, what kind of distribution of valences do they have, and what kinds of presences of various kinds of subsets. And I'll tell you by 15 minutes from now why we've been interested in that. But they turn out to be very unusual structures. Whereas those are sets of very low variety, regular lattices, because every neighborhood is like every other neighborhood. And so you have to go a long way out from any two nodes to see anything which is not isomorphic with the neighborhood of lots of other nodes. So those are sets with low variety. Okay, so boiling it all down, over the last, so the lineage of the work I'm about to show you came first from the work with Marina Cortez on energetic causal sets. Then I began working on an approach to quantum foundations and incorporated these ideas. It was called Real Ensemble Picture. And then I put those two things together and started thinking of views. And that's the causal view, the theory of causal views. And that is at least a model of a proposal for fundamental theory. So I imagine an evolving causal network propagating energy and momentum, as I've told you. You can describe the variety, and there are two related quantities that I've mentioned, the kinetic energy, which comes from just comparing the past of events and just previous events, and the potential energy, which comes from a causally related events. And I form a Lagrangian out of those. I add to it the exponential of those constraints that govern energy and momentum conservation. And notice that the Lagrange multipliers that exponentiate those constraints are called Z. And those are coordinates in the emergent space. That is, when space-time emerges, the Zs are the coordinates, but they have no dynamical meaning. They're just as long as Lagrange multipliers.
So Lee, can I just ask about the previous slide? The DIJs are real numbers, or they're supposed to be real valued numbers?
Real possible, yes.
Uh-huh. And they're the independent variables that you vary in this action?
No, the independent variables are the events and the causal relations. Then dependent on those are the views. And then I have a metric on the space of views that lets me compare them. And I'm hiding the details of all of that.
Okay.
Because I've got 15 minutes at most.
Okay.
So that's what the fundamental action looks like. The path integral, it looks conventional, but it differs. We call it the half integral rather than the path integral because there's no space. So we only are integrating over the P's, which are related to pairs of events. There's no position of the events. It's just the momentums exchanged by the events. The Q, which is the sum of the kinetic and potential energy, and the energy momentum conservation laws for each event, which are in a conservation delta function. So that's the whole theory. And notice in this fundamental description, as I keep saying, there's no space, there's no space-time. There's no H bar, there's no commutation relations, there's no uncertainty principle, and it's highly non-local. We're going to get space to emerge in the way that I described to reading order in the stationary phase approximation. But going off shell past that, there is, everything does not fit consistently into embedding of the events in space or space-time, just to leading order, because that's all we needed to. Past that, it's a theory of quantum gravity. Okay, I have to skip some stuff because I think I'm coming on having at most sort of 5 or 10 minutes. So we're going to skip a bunch of really interesting stuff, which you'll have to ask me about. And I want to briefly touch on, and then this, I'm going to talk about new stuff. I want to briefly touch on the question of why these laws. And as I said at the beginning, the same reasons why I'm motivated to look at quantum gravity and quantum foundations the way I do in terms of the principles of relationalism leads me to wonder, why do we have the particular laws and coupling constants and so forth in the standard model and not others? And to propose that the result, the explanation has to be a dynamical one. And this, by the way, was not, I thought it was original, but it was not original with me. And among the people who had been thinking about this, obviously, for a long time before, are the American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, who wrote clearly about this in 1893. And so I'm very indebted to him. And so keep that in mind. I want to say one thing about duality, and then I'm going to, I hope, surprise everybody. So we're taking a twist that for 5 minutes will seem, why are we doing this? But let's do it. So Laurent likes to talk about born duality and taking it as a fundamental principle. So let's imagine we have some fundamental dynamical system. I don't know, I don't care what its degrees of freedom of, motions of particles in some space or whatever you like. And there's a momentum P and a position X. And we need a time, we need things, we're interested in dynamics. So we need some time variable to talk about how the P and X change in time. And we write an action and we always start integral over time. The momentum times the time derivative of the position or the configuration. And that tells you that it's a canonical dynamical theory, is when the action starts off with that structure. But now I'm going to come along with my relational worries. And I'm going to say that time is a fixed structure. It's not dynamical. It doesn't come from anywhere. It's, nobody tells me how the clocks that measure that time relate to everything else in the universe. So I'm going to try to see if I can make the time dynamical. And so I'm going to be interested in a theory where there's three dynamical objects for every degree of freedom, a configuration or position, a momentum, and a dynamical time. So I'm going to use some technology, which I apologize if there will be people here who don't know it, but maybe some will know it, which is that I'm going to express every object as a big matrix. And let me just assure you that that's, it's not just in quantum mechanics where you can represent dynamical degrees of freedom in terms of big matrices. So I'm going to locate the momentum is in terms of the matrix elements of a big matrix. I'm going to locate the positions somehow in the construction of big matrices. And the d by dt, I'm going to construct also a big matrix that has the property that it gives me the time derivatives of the other quantities when you take a commutator. And so let's call W0 the matrix that takes derivatives, W1 the matrix of positions, and W2 the matrix of momenta. And then I can see an interesting place the structure may have come from, which is I can take the three matrices, take their anti-symmetric combination, trace them and call that an action. And indeed, that gives me, if I find a solution, the equations of motion are as simple as they could be. They're that every pair of those three matrices commute. And I can find solutions which allow me to give back the interpretation in terms of a clock watching the position and momentum evolve. But I have more symmetry. And what I've done is elevate a duality symmetry to a triality symmetry. And I've used this matrix construction to do this. Well, we gotta move, but this is a very interesting structure. This is a theory for which the degrees of freedom are three large matrices. I can even put them together. I can take the first one and multiply a sigma one, the second one and multiply a sigma two, the third one multiply a sigma three, add them up together and I have one matrix M, and my action is just M cubed trace. So nothing can be simpler. And I certainly, I have 2 minutes, I don't have time to show you that many theories of interest come out of solutions to that theory in the limit that the size of matrices goes to infinity, including Chern-Simons theory, which is a theory that many of us are interested in, from quantum matter to quantum gravity, but also BF theory, which is a topological field theory as well, also general relativity in a form called the Lebesgue action, also general relativity coupled to Yang-Mills fields for any gauge group, plus certain string theories. There's an enormous amount of different interesting physics hidden in that simple, simple theory. And that's my tool for studying ideas about unification. And it's all based on this idea of taking dualities and elevating them to triality. Now, I'm going to tell you, and here's some detail, but we don't have time for detail, but we can come back to it if you want. With the people I mentioned, Stefan, Michael, Will, David, and Jaron, we've been staring for about the better part of a year at this correspondence between gauge field theories and matrix models, which has, of course, and it's completely explicit way to connect, to go from a matrix in the limit that n goes to infinity to a gauge field, or some gauge field, any gauge group you run. And we've been wondering if we can elevate that duality to a triality. And here's what we've discovered. We were, for other reasons, looking at the machine learning language and its development. We realized that there's a three-way triality, and that the other corner is these dynamical learning machines. That is, we have a completely explicit correspondence between learning machines, i.e. the algorithms that are constructed from neural networks, et cetera, and gauge field theories and matrix models. The way we actually construct the relationship, the correspondence between the gauge field theories and the learning machines is by going through matrix models. But we have that relation explicitly. There is a very well studied learning machine which is called the reduced Boltzmann machine. It had the common structure of these learning machines is they have nodes and layers, which are then connected by a bunch of wires, which are called the weights. And all of them, all of the values of the field at the nodes and the values of the weights are dynamical degrees of freedom. And these, you put these through certain dynamical protocols and you learn stuff as your machine and is able to do all the fabulous job with translation and recognition problems and so forth. And I am far from somebody who believes that we are machines or that artificial intelligence devices emulate us. But here it is. That turns out to be closely related. That is, we can code the equations of motion of general relativity using that Lebesgue parameterization into that two-surface or two-layer machine learning algorithm or device. And again, we have this completely explicit. That's a sketch of it. The whole of the Turing-Simon theory, with all of those different possible compactifications leading to various combinations of general relativity and gauge fields, is coded into a three-layer device, which we propose and hope that people will build and study. So this is, to us, surprising. We're just putting out a paper, which is a long paper that discusses the ins and outs of this correspondence, but we hope you find it interesting. Thank you.
All right. Let's thank Lee for that great talk. Feel free to unmute yourself. So can I start by asking whether there are any questions from students? If not, are you sure, students? This could be your time. Push your button.
I guess I have a question.
Go for it.
I guess I'm particularly interested in the application of neural networks and matrix models and applying this to the Turing-Simon's theory. So is this in relation to what you were talking about earlier with causal sets? Are we able to think of if we have a causal set and we have points and then we have relationships between those with causality relations? Are we able to think of those as neural networks? And is that kind of some analogy we can draw, or is that kind of a different way of thinking?
Yes, it's part of what motivated us. And there are a lot of things to say that, of course, I didn't get a chance to fill in. But let me just emphasize, first of all, that we mean it. That is, we believe those are not equivalences, but they're correspondences, and we believe that they could be useful in several different directions. One of them is making models of gauge and gravity dynamics in terms of these new devices, because we certainly can write the correspondences in such a way that what the neural network learns is a solution to general relativity coupled to gauge fields, say. And I'm speaking now classically, but there may also be quantum mechanical results we're thinking about. But we're also wondering two other things. One of them is if somebody in the future could build these devices so that the gravitational and gauge fields were the building blocks out of which a learning machine could be constructed. And maybe that's 5 years in the future, maybe it's done and probably can't be realized, maybe it's 100 years in the future. But what it suggests is even that the degrees of freedom of nature could evolve in such a way that we should and would have an opportunity to say that nature, the vacuum, in picking out of the intricate possibilities, its vacuum, is learning. That is, it's not any more radical than many people have speculated goes on exploring the landscape of string theories or string quantification. But we would have a powerful language to understand why certain vacuum were chosen. And it would be that the dynamical system we're talking about, which is the vacuum, learned something. And if that sounds insane, it sounded insane to me for about 6 months. What you have to do, or at least what I had to do, is think carefully about why we have any right to say that these machines, which are really algorithms, learn. Why should we say that what they do is learn? And why should we apply the vocabulary of learning to what they do? But once you've thought that out, or once we have carefully thought it out, we have a language to talk about when some device learns. And we can ask, can the choice of a vacuum of a quantum field theory satisfy the conditions that it's useful to say that it learned something? But maybe we missed something. This is hot off the press, so to speak. But those are all the things that we're sort of thinking about at the same time as we try to get the paper.
Okay. Any other, well, maybe any other student questions before we open it up? If not, any questions from anyone else? Daniel, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so Lee, I'm kind of curious about the connection with quantum mechanics, and maybe you could elaborate a little more on that. So in particular, one thing I'm wondering is, it sounded like the similarity between views is giving rise to entanglement, but similarity should have some sort of transitivity property, right? If A and B, because it's maybe triangle inequality is the relevant thing. If A and B are similar to each other and B and C are similar, then A and C could also be similar. But that's kind of the opposite of how entanglement behaves, which is monogamous. If A and B are entangled, then A can't be entangled with C.
Yes. I agree that's a worry. And so what, maybe can we talk about this to answer? So first of all, that is a good question. I think I know the answer to it, but to explain it will take 10 or 15 minutes of introducing all the structure that I didn't. So would you terribly mind talking about this offline?
Okay, we can probably do that.
Okay, it's an excellent question, and I have worried about it, and I hope that what I came up with is sufficient, but.
Maybe I actually misunderstood. So I think I thought the similarity of views was a sort of measurement of spatial closeness, or is that not the idea?
Both are true. So there's the space of views, and on the space of views we have a probability distribution which represents the views of the different events in the system at a given time. And I try to develop dynamics for the evolution of that probability distribution. One of the technical steps is I have to find that it's non-negative in the sense that if a view is occupied, it's only occupied at most once, and most views are not occupied. And if I can satisfy that condition, then I can do a certain coarse graining and derive from the function that describes the acausal variety a differential equation, which becomes what's called the Bohm potential, the Bohm-Kleinman potential. And having that in the leading order equation, stochastic differential equation to propagate that probability distribution is why I get to derive the Schrödinger equation. So I'm just saying the steps along the way. I come out, if I don't have a lot of copies of a system, I don't come anywhere near the Schrödinger equation. So by definition, this is a many-body system. And it's easiest if I also take the non-relativistic limit and discuss the many-body non-relativistic systems. Now, entanglement in this language, this is a wave functions of probability distributions over configuration space, is related to whether the probability distributions are factorable. And they're simply do emerge. I was able to find a few. They do emerge solutions which are entangled. I think to come back to let's see if there's another question.
Sure. Is there another question? I have another question, actually, which is something I think you might have said this, but is a view just sort of the, if you want, the past light cone, the events in your past, or is a view include the both future and past?
No, not definitely just the past.
And then is there a way do you manage to get the kind of time symmetry of the classical laws to come out naturally, or is it hard to achieve that, or how does that go?
Good. So we study this a lot with Neumann, and there are the following things we understand, and there's one thing maybe we don't understand. The dynamics as the rules that I specified, and I left one thing out of the rules, are irreversible. And you can think of this like a discrete dynamical system on a big space of states where there's a deterministic rule. If you're on a state, there's a deterministic rule that tells you what the next state, and the next state, and the next state, and the next state. And whereas there's not a unique prior state, a given state which is occupied now could have been previously, that is, that system could have previously been on more than one prior state. So there are trajectories that converge in one direction and to determinist, going forward you're deterministic and going backward you're not. So on the other hand, when we, meaning Marina, ran simulations of a large number of these systems, many of them had the property that they settled into a phase which appeared reversible. And eventually, they settle down to phases where the changes look like motions of particles in the background, and we could easily just reverse the trajectories, and they would look like solutions, at least temporarily. And so we understood, and this is in one of our papers, we understood that what was going on was that our systems were getting trapped by limit cycles. And when they were in limit cycles, they were actually still irreversible, but it was hard to tell. Because if you're in a limit cycle, there's always a unique past element which is still part of that limit cycle. In other words, whenever there's a branching, one of them takes you out of the limit cycle and one of them keeps you in the limit cycle. So you can identify after a certain amount of time, there's a good chance that everybody is on a limit cycle. And you can invert once you're there and make a well-defined inverse dynamics. Am I making sense so far?
Yes, thank you. Are there any other questions? If not, why don't we thank Lee one more time for our wonderful talk.